From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Deadly attack on popular hotel in the Libyan capital. Children go underground in eastern Ukraine. New hope for Pakistan and Afghanistan's battle against drug trafficking. New York City dodges a big weather bullet. These stories and more coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. An attack on a Tripoli hotel popular with politicians and international visitors killed at least 9 people Tuesday. Libyan officials say 5 of the dead are foreigners, including 1 American. According to Libyan authorities, the gunman set off a car bomb outside the Carinthia Hotel before storming the building and firing weapons. The attackers then blew themselves up. A group calling itself the Tripoli Province of the Islamic State claimed responsibility in an online statement. The leader of Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels called for a peaceful transfer of power Tuesday. In an appearance on the rebels' television station, Abdul Malik al-Houthi said he invites all free and honorable people to what he called a large, inclusive, and historic meeting Friday in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The rebels freed presidential chief of staff Ahmed Awad bin Mubarak, who was kidnapped from his car 10 days ago. That sparked fighting, leading to the resignation of the government. Kurdish fighters widened their offensive Tuesday against Islamic State strongholds near Kobani, a day after claiming recapture of the embattled town on the Syrian border with Turkey. The Kurds say they took control of a nearby village. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights confirmed the report. President Obama traveled to Saudi Arabia on Tuesday to pay his respects following last week's death of 90-year-old Saudi King Abdullah. Mr. Obama made a brief stop in the capital, Riyadh, where he also met for the first time with new Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz. The two leaders discussed a variety of Middle East security issues and stability on the oil market. A U.S. official also says President Obama brought up the issue of human rights. Mr. Obama's brief stop in Saudi Arabia took place after cutting short a 3-day official visit to India. VOA's Arup Pandey reports from New Delhi.
After nearly 3 days of wooing India's prime minister and business leaders, President Obama took his message of a new chapter in U.S.-India relations directly to the Indian people on Tuesday.
I'm here because I'm absolutely convinced that both our peoples will have more jobs and opportunity, and our nations will be more secure, and the world will be safer and a more just place when our two democracies, the world's largest democracy and the world's oldest democracy, stand together.
Speaking to an audience of 1,500 people in New Delhi's Siri Fort Tuesday, Mr. Obama said together the United States and India can improve the lives of their people and reduce poverty through increased trade and investment in infrastructure and renewable energy. The U.S. president added that in order to be true global partners, both nations must confront and lead the effort to fight climate change. The United States and India are the world's largest polluters after China, and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said he is ready to work with President Obama towards a global deal to cut emissions during the December United Nations Climate Summit. Mr. Obama acknowledged that it might seem unfair to ask a developing and emerging economy like India to reduce its dependence on fossil fuels.
But here's the truth. Even if countries like the United States curb our emissions, if countries that are growing rapidly like India, with soaring energy needs, don't also embrace cleaner fuels, then we don't stand a chance against climate change.
The bulk of the president's final remarks in India Tuesday spoke to empowering youth and promoting equality. He drew cheers when speaking of women's rights, saying that if nations truly want to prosper, they cannot ignore the talents of half their people. 2 years ago, the brutal gang rape and murder of a young woman aboard a New Delhi bus shook India, sparking widespread protests.
Because every girl's life matters. Every daughter deserves the same chance as our sons. Every woman should be able to go about her day, to walk the streets or ride the bus and be safe and be treated with respect and dignity. She deserves that.
The American leader also spoke out against religious intolerance, saying every person has the right to practice their faith how they choose and to do so free from persecution and fear, President Obama invoked the deadly 2012 shooting at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin and quoted Mahatma Gandhi's words that the different religions are beautiful flowers from the same garden. Arup Pandey, VOA News, New Delhi.
Ukraine's parliament approved a statement Tuesday labeling Russia as an aggressor state. Ukrainian legislators also voted to designate the Russia-backed separatist so-called People's Republics in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk and Luhansk regions as terrorist organizations. The UN Children's Fund reports more than 1,000 children are forced to seek refuge in underground bomb shelters in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk because of the ongoing fighting and heavy shelling. UNICEF says those children are living in appalling conditions and are in urgent need of help. Lisa Schlein has details.
The UN Children's Fund says children in conflict-ridden eastern Ukraine are suffering enormous levels of stress. The agency's staff is expressing surprise at the depth of suffering and deprivation to which some of these children are being subjected. A UNICEF team recently visited Donetsk, which is under intense fire from government and rebel forces. Speaking from the capital, Kiev, UNICEF representative in Ukraine, Giovanna Barberis, told VOA the team was able to go to rebel-controlled areas. She says they did a hurried assessment of 12 underground bomb shelters and found an estimated 1,000 children hiding there.
Now, obviously, parents and adults are with these children, but children are not going out very often because, of course, of the security situation. So they're dropping out of school or not being able to receive proper health care. We are monitoring the situation, but of course we are very, very concerned with the situation of these children.
Barberis describes these underground bomb shelters as unsanitary, crowded, and freezing. She says the children are traumatized and many are at risk of disease due to lack of hygiene and vaccines. She says even before the crisis, the number of children vaccinated against killer diseases was low. She says only about 50% of Ukraine's nearly 8 million children have been vaccinated. She adds a possible resurgence of polio is particularly worrisome. She says an estimated 1.7 million children are affected by the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Especially hard hit are those in shelters.
They are living without proper heating, lack of sanitation, limited water and food supplies, and certainly they have also been the hardest hit by the extremely harsh winter weather conditions. And lack of medicines in the areas of ongoing fighting put children's lives really in danger.
UNICEF has provided hygiene kits to more than 1,100 children and adults living in shelters and basements. The agency says it soon will begin providing winter clothing kits to at least 10,000 vulnerable children in the conflict-affected areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
About 300 survivors of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Nazi concentration camp gathered Tuesday at the site in Poland for the 70th anniversary of its liberation to pay their respects to victims who perished in gas chambers or from inhumane treatment and disease. Roman Kent, an Auschwitz survivor, spoke at the ceremony.
I hope and believe that this generation will build on mankind's great traditions tempered by understanding that these traditions must embrace pluralism and tolerance, decency and human rights for all people.
When Auschwitz was liberated on January 27, 1945, by the Soviet Army, soldiers found 7,000 prisoners, among them 130 children. At least 37 people were injured Tuesday, including 22 policemen, during violent unrest in Kosovo's capital, Pristina. Police officers fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse several thousand anti-government protesters demanding the resignation of a Serb cabinet minister accused of insulting the ethnic Albanian majority. An economist who is an outspoken critic of Greece's bailout deal with international lenders was named Tuesday as the country's finance minister in the new leftist government. anti-austerity Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras picked Yanis Varoufakis for the key economic portfolio.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Increasing counterterrorism and border security cooperation between Pakistan and Afghanistan are raising hopes for more effective anti-drug regional efforts. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad.
Despite significant international investment to counter illicit drug production in Afghanistan, a recent UN survey says the country has seen a surge in poppy cultivation area for a third consecutive year. Pakistani authorities say the increase in Afghan drugs coupled with the withdrawal of the bulk of NATO forces from the war-shattered country poses even a bigger challenge to their counter-narcotics efforts. Pakistan Anti-Narcotics Force head Major General Khawar Hanif told a UN-sponsored international conference in Islamabad, continued international involvement is needed to tackle the Afghan drug problem.
Thankfully, the commitment of the present Afghan government with respect to border control arrangements and counter-narcotic efforts is quite palpable. However, we believe that unless there is a wholehearted support from the international community proportionate to the drug problem, the region is going to remain in the same crisis. Abandoning our Afghan colleagues to deal with this overwhelming poppy cultivation and drug production is not an option at all.
Pakistan shares a 2,500-kilometer, mostly porous border with Afghanistan. General Hanif says the terrain poses challenges to the country's fight against terrorism and drugs trafficking.
A lot of divided villages, as you can see on the borders, facilitate in movement across the border both ways. And you actually enter into a village from one country and get out in the other. There are more than 200 unfrequented routes in which practically there are no law enforcement agencies present.
Representative for the UN Anti-Drugs Office in Pakistan, Cesar Gudez, says the alarming drug situation in the region requires enhanced joint efforts.
I think that is the key element for success in combating drugs trafficking in this part of the world. The main producing country plus the main transit country need to strengthen their efforts effectively, very professionally, and with all the sectors in both countries joining efforts to tackle this regional problem.
He says the preferred market of the Afghan narcotics is Europe, and Pakistan serves as the main transit route.
It's approximately 45 to 50% of the opiates produced in Afghanistan that use Pakistan as a preferred stepping stone on Western international market. Then about 30% goes via the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the balance, 20-something percent, via the Central Asian republics onwards to Russia and Europe.
Pakistani officials say the proliferation of Afghan drugs has also led to an increase in drug addiction in Pakistan. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A key U.S. senator will hold off on a vote for additional Iran sanctions over its nuclear program. Democratic Senator Robert Menendez says he will delay pushing his own bill to impose more sanctions until after March 24th, an interim deadline in the international talks with Iran. President Obama does not want Congress to vote on increased sanctions, fearing it could jeopardize negotiations with Iran. VOA's Cindy Sain has more on Capitol Hill.
Senator Robert Menendez said he was proud to lead bipartisan efforts to impose additional tough sanctions on Iran to make clear there will be consequences if international talks fail. He is the co-sponsor, along with Republican Senator Mark Kirk, of the Nuclear Free Iran Act. Menendez, however, surprised many by making this announcement at Tuesday's Senate Banking Committee hearing on Iran.
This morning, however, many of my Democratic colleagues and I have sent a letter to the president telling him that we will not support passage of the Kirk-Menendez bill on the Senate floor until after March 24th, and only if there is no political framework agreement, because, as the letter states, We remain hopeful that diplomacy will succeed in reversing Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon capability.
Menendez did make clear that he is still skeptical that Iran truly wants to reach a deal. Also at the hearing, Republican Senator Bob Corker, who now chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said this change of heart by Menendez is a game changer.
If we want to speak with one voice and show strength to Iran, it's likely that we're not going to vote on the Senate floor on sanctions until after March 24th.
Speaking for the Obama administration, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken again made a strong appeal for Congress to hold off any planned votes on additional sanctions. Blinken said he knows that Congress' intentions are good, but the consequences of a vote now could be disastrous.
It is our considered judgment and strongly held view that new sanctions at this time are unnecessary and, far from enhancing the prospect of negotiations, risk fatally undermining our diplomacy, making a deal less likely, and unraveling the sanctions regime so many in this body have worked so hard to establish.
Blinken said a vote on additional sanctions could make U.S. allies think that Washington is not serious about reaching an agreement and give hardliners in Iran an excuse to pull out of the talks. President Obama has threatened to veto any congressional bill imposing more sanctions on Iran now. And even though Republicans hold majorities in both the House and the Senate, they would need significant Democratic support to override a veto. Cindy Sain, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
A powerful winter storm dropped as much as 60 centimeters of snow in some parts of the northeastern United States, leaving millions of residents stranded in their homes. Boston and surrounding New England took the brunt of the storm, as near-record snowfall and high winds caused blizzard conditions. Storm-driven flooding added to the woes of those who live in coastal areas. The northeastern states of Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut received some of the heaviest snow. But the storm fell short of forecasters' worst predictions farther south, particularly in New York City. And that's creating another kind of storm, as William Gallo explains.
New Yorkers woke up Tuesday to a significant amount of snowfall. But nowhere near the historic levels predicted by forecasters. In Manhattan's largely deserted Times Square, residents were underwhelmed.
Turned out to be nothing. I mean, it's some accumulation, but not what you expected it to be.
I was expecting 2 feet, and it's only like a couple of inches, so they're making a big deal out of it. Nothing. So I didn't think it was that bad.
Ahead of the storm, officials took the unusual step of shutting down rail and subway lines and even imposed a travel ban on roads. New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo on Tuesday defended that decision, saying it was better to be safe than sorry.
I would rather, if there's a lean one way or the other, if you will, lean towards safety, because I've seen the consequences the other way. And it gets very frightening very quickly. And I've seen people put in extraordinarily dangerous situations. And we've had people die in storms.
William Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
On the medical front, the vaccine alliance known as Gavi expects the U.S. government to announce a $1 billion pledge. Gavi provides vaccines in developing countries. At the same time, in the United States, many parents are rejecting vaccines for their children. One result is a measles outbreak in Southern California. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that 68 people, including young children, have come down with the disease.
It started here in Disneyland, often portrayed as the happiest place on Earth. Since January 1st, it's also been known as ground zero of a measles outbreak in the U.S. that may have far-reaching consequences. Measles is a highly contagious disease. It can rob a child of hearing, vision, intellect, and even life. Yet a significant number of American parents, including many in California, are choosing not to vaccinate their children. They cite concerns about side effects, including autism, but there is no link between autism and the vaccine, say specialists like Dr. Martha Rivera.
There's no risk of autism. That was disproven. So it is a good, safe vaccine, and all the fear factors have been taken away.
Some of the world's top infectious disease experts say vaccines are not only medically effective, they are cost-effective, eliminating the financial burden of treating preventable diseases. Dr. Anthony Fauci spoke about this in an earlier interview with VOA.
If you had to pick out one intervention, if you balance the investment you make in the research and the implementation with the health benefit, vaccines have to be either the top or very much in the short list.
Dr. Seth Berkley agrees.
Vaccines are, among the most effective and cost-effective interventions that exist.
In the U.S., experts say childhood diseases have become rare because vaccines are so effective. In this sense, vaccines are a victim of their own success. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
White House security was breached again this week when a small remote-controlled drone crashed on its lawn. The drone was a quadcopter with four propellers. The U.S. Secret Service is investigating the incident, but drone experts say there is no reliable way to protect against these now widely available devices. VOA's George Putich explains.
This was not the first incident of a flying machine on the grounds of the White House. In September 1994, a pilot crashed a small Cessna airplane onto the South Lawn, prompting re-evaluation of security procedures. But the latest incident again highlighted the increased vulnerability of the traditional home of the U.S. presidents. Thanks to advances in cheap electronics, lightweight materials, and mechanical parts, drones are now available to anyone. The Federal Aviation Administration, which regulates U.S. airspace, limits the flights of drones operated by hobbyists to a height of about 120 meters and within sight of the operator. But modern drones can be pre-programmed to fly automatically along so-called waypoints. According to Illinois Institute of Technology Robotics Lab Associate Professor Matthew Spenko, some manufacturers program their drones so they cannot be operated in certain areas, but the system is not immune to hacking.
If you're smart enough and you know what you're doing, you can always override that.
Spenko says quadcopters can carry up to 6 kilograms of payload. The best among them can stay airborne for 25 minutes and fly as fast as 10 meters per second. University of Nebraska journalism professor Matthew Waite studies how drones can be used to report news. He says Monday's incident may have some bad consequences.
I've been saying for years that it's going to take one idiot doing something stupid to trigger a lot of bad policy. And I'm afraid that we may have found our idiot.
Waite says the White House is well protected, but a motivated person can still create a lot of chaos.
If somebody wants to cause harm and havoc with a device and some explosives, there's very little to stop them. And that's just kind of the way of the world.
The Secret Service does not have a reliable system to identify and disable drones. After the latest incident, Waite says the agency will no doubt reconsider its options, but he thinks the danger from drones is small.
Could you do damage with it? Absolutely. Are you going to level a building with it? No, probably not. So, there's a threat here, but it's, in the grand scheme of other threats, I think it's pretty low.
Much as other modern devices, drones are here to stay, so governments and regulators will have to come up with comprehensive regulations to control their use. In the meantime, private companies are already seeing the potential for a lucrative business, devices that protect us from drones. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On January 28, 814, Charlemagne, also known as Charles the Great, King of the Franks, died. Charlemagne attempted to bring order and stability to Europe through a series of conquests and reforms. At the end of a 30-year military campaign, he was the undisputed ruler of much of Western Europe. On this day in 1521, the Diet of Worms began, lasting until May 25th. The deliberative assembly of the Holy Roman Empire met to consider what to do about the Protestant Reformation. On this day in 1596, Sir Francis Drake, privateer and first Englishman to circumnavigate the world, died off the coast of Spanish-held Puerto Rico. A bane to the Spanish, Drake was instrumental in the defeat of the Spanish-led Armada off the English coast in 1588. In 1807, Pall Mall in London became the world's first city street lighted with gas. The illumination made travel safer and reduced crime, so the popularity of gas street lighting quickly increased. On this day in 1871, Prussian forces converged on Paris during the Franco-Prussian War, laying siege to the French capital for more than 4 months until the French agreed to surrender. On this day in 1915, the U.S. Coast Guard was established by an act of Congress and signed by President Woodrow Wilson. In 1965, the current maple leaf design of the flag of Canada was proclaimed by Queen Elizabeth after approval by the Canadian Parliament. The flag was officially inaugurated the following month. And on January 28, 1986, the U.S. Space Shuttle Challenger exploded 73 seconds after liftoff. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
America's prosperity and Asia's prosperity are inseparable. Our shared prosperity and shared security are just as tightly linked. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Daniel Russell said recently to an international business group in New York City. America's alliances and partnerships have guaranteed security within the Asia region for 7 decades, which has served as the foundation for increased economic ties and growth in the region. Trade with Australia nearly doubled in the last decade. The U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement was implemented. An open skies agreement with Japan liberalized air travel, and much more. We are working actively to ensure that a stable security environment underwrites economic growth for the Asia-Pacific instead of instability threatening progress, Assistant Secretary Russell said. No country can provide the public good of regional security in the way the United States can. At the top of the United States business agenda for 2015 is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. In this uncertain political environment, and with growth flat in the European Union and slowing in China, the importance of the Trans-Pacific Partnership could not be clearer, he said. The Trans-Pacific Partnership will strengthen America's role as one of the most competitive, most innovative economies in the world, as well as one of the biggest trading partners and source and destination of foreign investment in the region, Assistant Secretary Russell emphasized. Just as important, a high-quality Trans-Pacific Partnership will strengthen our partner economies and other regional economies that share the priority we place on labor, environmental, and intellectual property standards, and on fair competition. I believe the United States and the Asia-Pacific region will continue to grow and prosper together, he said in conclusion, but it depends on wise leadership in both our political and commercial capitals here and in the region. And it depends on businesses making and strengthening connections across the Pacific.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.